Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all struggle with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Bree. Well done. And thanks. Welcome to the show. Yes, today I am putting on my hat as educator, I guess is the primary focus for the show, but also drawing on my life as a parent and now my life as a grandparent to kind of see where we're going in the world of education and what exactly is the purpose of a public school education. And I'm happy to be back here in the studio today, which is nice after a long summer break of traveling the country. And I'm looking forward to hearing from you today when we open up the phones, hear how your summer's been or what your take is on public education. Also, we're going to talk about maybe some of the things that you're concerned about when it comes to getting back to school. Like for me, for example, what happened to Labor Day weekend? How did we get to this place where we were starting school in the middle of August? And there was something, you know, kind of sacred about getting to the end of the summer and having Labor Day weekend. And I can remember, you know, going over to the school the weekend before, the Friday before the long weekend when the classrooms were posted and you knew who your teacher was going to be. So, you know, things have changed. We seem to be speeding up that summer break and that opportunity for doing learning outside of the classroom. And we're also jumping back into the school year with a lot more breaks than we used to have, a lot more days off, teacher work days or longer Thanksgiving breaks. And I wonder how that might disrupt learning. Those are just some of the things that are kind of going around in my head today. I think what, you know, inspired the show was seeing all of the first day of school photos popping up all over the place, on Facebook primarily, but on Instagram, and emailed pictures from my siblings. And I love the first day of school photos. I look forward to them every year. And I have a whole series of the first day of school photos of my daughters. And if you follow us on Facebook or on Instagram, you can check out a couple photos that I put up of the girls. I don't know how much they'll love them, but they're fun memories for me. You know, there's something about marking that first day and seeing either the excitement or the terror in your children's eyes when they're setting out for, you know, that this next 9 months, wondering what it's going to be like, wondering who their friends will be, what their teachers, you know, will be like. And I think there's something beautiful about tracking those first day of school photos and to go back and look at them at the end of the year and to be able to have a conversation with your students, your kids, and to say, hey, look at you on that first day back in, you know, now August. And you were excited and a little nervous and you didn't know what it was going to be like. And tell me how you're feeling now when you look at that picture 9 months later. How was this school year? You know, how are you different than you were that day, that first day of junior high or that first day of high school or that first day of college? And it's great to have that conversation piece so your children can see that picture and kind of remember back to how they were feeling and reflect on it. Because reflection is really important for our growth year after year, is to be able to look back and understand how we got there. So the first day of school photos, it kind of inspired this topic. And also a couple of conversations that I had over the summer inspired this topic. At the beginning of my journey, I flew out to Denver. That was kind of the starting point. And on my flight to Denver, I struck up a conversation with the people sitting next to me. And the husband owned a tech firm up in the Bay Area, and we were talking a lot about his children. He had children that were about to leave high school, and we're looking at colleges and all that goes into the college prep and what classes to take. And you know, we started talking about what did he look for in an education? Did he think his children were getting, you know, what they needed? And it was interesting because he said, you know, from my perspective, every student needs to leave high school, maybe if not earlier in junior high, being able to speak the language of computer science, learning the language of coding, as if, you know, they're learning a second language, because it's so inherent in our day-to-day life. Being able to speak and communicate in that language is going to help you to accommodate or adapt to the rapidly changing technologies of our culture or just the lifestyle of our culture. And I thought that was really interesting because I never really thought about the whole changes in technology and the software, you know, world as being a specific language, as learning how to communicate in this whole different plane with other people. And he said, and it's not necessarily, you know, I want my children to study in college because I think there's a lot of other things that they need to study and understand to have a broader ability to adapt to the changing society. But he said, I really want them to be able to speak the language so that they can navigate anything that comes their way. And we don't know where technology is going to take us. So, you know, as long as our children have these skills that they can draw on, they'll be better prepared. And isn't preparation for life really what it's all about? So I was curious, you know, to know what other people thought about that. Should there be a added curriculum to our schools that computer science or computer science language becomes part of that? And another thing that came up over the summer was the kind of the idea of how we best prepare our children for the workforce or life after school. And what is it that we are, you know, really creating our public schools to do? What is the point and purpose of a public education? And we've talked about it before here, you know, a little bit about the history of public education, but I think it warrants a continued conversation because what I find interesting is that we don't have one national curriculum or even one national goal for public education. It's really led by school boards in each of the different school districts or by the state. But school boards have a lot of influence in these individual school districts on what kind of things are emphasized or offered in each individual school district. And it's interesting because we don't talk a lot about school boards or what they're doing or who's running for office. And I know we have school board seats up in this coming November election. And do we know really what our school board's goals are? So that's kind of where I'm at today. I'd love to hear about your summer. I'd love to hear about that first day of school and those first day of school traditions and what is it that you like to share with your children. I'm going to talk about the idea of, you know, what our kids need to know to succeed and what is the point of a public school education. What is it? What is our goal as parents? Because it really comes down to us. Those of us who are raising children or those of us who are grandparents and think we're going to have some influence on our grandchildren. Those of us who work with children, you know, anyone who spends time influencing the lives of young people from kindergarten through higher ed, you know, we are the ones that determine how well prepared our children are, this next generation is, for taking on the tasks and challenges and struggles of their adult life. And so what is it that we value and want to pass along to our children? Because part of my concern is that, you know, in the craziness of our busy, busy lives, we don't have time often to sit down and think about what is the quality of our children's day, day in and day out at school. Who are the people that are having such incredible influence on our children? You know, the teachers, the principals, the guests that come onto campus, the activities that the students are involved in. We are so busy just trying to keep our head above water. I don't know if as parents we get to sit down and think about, you know, what do I want my children to know when they leave home and set out on their own? In some ways, as parents, we really need to create a lesson plan of our own, a parenting plan, you know, that something that spans our child's lifetime or their childhood, and make sure that we've taught them and exposed them to all the things that we feel is important. Because if we leave it just to the schools and just kind of trust that we, you know, drop them off with their lunch bag on the first day of school and they're going to get everything they need to be successful and be healthy and to be socially, emotionally connected, we're going to be painfully disappointed with the outcome. Because I think we expect a bit too much from our school system. And as parents, I think we need to take more control over what it is we want our children to know and to learn so that they are ready to face the challenges and things that we value as a family. So this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I am Elizabeth Barrett here in the studio today. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, I'm always happy to hear from you. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of this conversation. You can also find us on our Facebook page or our new Instagram at The Reluctant Therapist. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org, or you can podcast our shows to listen at your convenience by going to iTunes or your podcast app on your device and punch in A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and you can subscribe. So we always love to hear from you. And it's nice because I feel like I've been talking a lot to myself this summer because I was on the road sending the shows in. But it's great to be back in the studio and I get to hear from you and know how things have been or how this topic or conversation is hitting you at this time. All right, so let's get started. Let's talk a little bit about the history of public education from a couple different perspectives. You know, we'll start back with Thomas Jefferson, who a lot of people consider to be kind of the father of public education, and he talked a lot about in his early writings some of his original ideas about public instruction. So, to paraphrase just a few of Thomas Jefferson's ideas, he felt that education in America was important so that we could plant and nurture the tree of liberty in every American heart. His hope is that public schools would not be compulsory, but actually desirable, that people would want to go to these schools, and that each student would have the opportunity to reach their educational goals, enter adulthood as a good citizen. They would be capable of fulfilling their self-determination, their purpose in life, and that these students would be able to show, the ones who showed specific talents, would be allowed to pursue these talents to their personal and social beneficial limits. Thomas Jefferson felt that an educated, self-governing electorate would be the best defense against tyranny. So it's interesting because, you know, even back at this time, Thomas Jefferson was understanding the need for good citizens in order to keep this free country moving forward, and also the idea of our inherent desire to understand our purpose in life, to feel motivated or excited or challenged by the opportunities. And so as the idea of public education grew, some of the early definitions or goals for public education were much more geared towards not as much the career aspect, but much more of developing the whole person. So there were six early goals for public education. One was to provide universal access to free education, because keeping in line with this idea of having an educated electorate to make sure that we were meeting the demands of our growing country. Number two was to guarantee equal opportunities for all children, so they'd have access to, you know, knowledge and education. Number three was to unify a diverse population, which I think continues to be one of our issues as a nation, is how do we take all of these very different backgrounds, religions, cultures, interests, and have some sort of unified identity as a nation. So that was one of the early goals of public education. Number four was to prepare people for citizenship in a democratic society. So teaching things like citizenship, ethics, how to vote, talk a lot about government. The idea was that a lot of people would be a part of the national service, would, you know, give of their time to run for office. You know, offices originally were supposed to be held by the common man, farmer, store owner, who would take the time out of their life, or, you know, come into town and serve their time in office and then go back to their original job. There really wasn't this idea that we would have career politicians that would spend their life serving the national interest, but actually, you know, regular people would take turns. And it's interesting because in Lincoln, Nebraska, when I was there and we took the tour of the state capitol, one of the points that the tour guide made was that the people who come in, you know, four or five times a year, I can't remember if it was five or six times a year to pass legislation and to talk about the role, you know, what was happening in the state. They all returned to their home districts, and a lot of them just had their regular job, their way of making money, and that they weren't career politicians. And I found that fascinating. And I wonder how we, you know, got away from that point of the average citizen and self-government. But to continue on the definition of public education, number five, the idea was to prepare people to become economically self-sufficient. So that makes sense. We want everyone to be able to provide for themselves. And number six was to improve social conditions. The idea was that if people were able to access jobs that paid a higher wage, that their quality of life would go up. So those were some of the original intentions of public education. And as we've moved along, in our more current definition of public education, there's a lot more emphasis on preparing students for their work life and for college, preparing students to be ready to take on whatever is the workforce or what some of the goals are of the nation. For example, at the turn of the century, and this is the 20th century, not the 21st, but at the turn of the century, there was the move from farms, agricultural life, to the Industrial Revolution, which, you know, moved a lot of mostly men at that time into the workforce, into working in factories. And so it was important that our public school system at that time was training people to be able to be lever pullers, to be able to work in factories, to be able to, you know, be efficient and be counted on and be able to read and write. And so that kind of pushed the direction of public education at that time. It also was when we started to develop a universal high school education, that high school became a mandatory part of the public school education. Because prior to that, a lot of people dropped out in sixth grade or seventh grade or eighth grade. But at the turn of the century, with the change in needs of our corporations or our companies at the time, we needed to change our education system. And that continued along until the 50s. And in 1957, when Sputnik, the Soviet Union satellite, was launched, that was a horrible defeat for the United States, that the government really was unhappy with this idea that the Soviet Union had beat us into space, and how could that happen? And clearly, our public education was not, you know, preparing our young people to be scientists and mathematicians that would have helped us win the space race. So as a result, in 1958 or 59, they signed the National Defense Education Act. And this act increased funding for education across the board on all levels, but really focused on science and technology as the main emphasis in schools, and also gave a lot of low-interest loans to individuals to go into college so we would have the next generation of engineers, which is interesting because then if you follow that out, we see how quickly things turned around in the United States into the space race. The next big change we see in education is kind of post-feminist movement. And any of you who raised children in the 80s like I did, you would have seen the Take Your Daughter to Work Day that started in 1995. And this was an attempt to get young girls thinking about careers and jobs and not as much about just going, you know, working at home or taking care of children. And so this was kind of an effort by Ms. Magazine and Gloria Steinem to get daughters going to see what their fathers did at work or what their mothers did, and to be thinking about, you know, different kind of careers. And that, of course, has changed. In 2003, it became Take Your Daughters and Sons to Work. So we've seen kind of these shifts in education over the years, but we haven't, you know, really ever come upon one universal idea of what is it our kids need to know when they graduate? What are the goals of an education? You know, on one hand, it's to develop the whole student, a good citizen, moral values, unify the population. But on the other hand, we're trying to develop the next workforce and what is being demanded of our workers in that area. So this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist, and our phones are open, 805-781-3875. I'd love to hear from you. What do you think are the goals of an education? What is it you want for your children? As I said earlier, you know, I think that the public school system is important in helping to develop our children, their skills, their confidence, their abilities, the basics, reading, writing, and arithmetic. But there is a great part of education that really has to be fostered by parents. I think that's part of the wonders of a summer vacation, is that you have this opportunity to expose your children to things that they might not be learning at school, that'll be just as fundamentally important when they get out into the world and they are trying to make a life for themselves. Who will introduce your children to nature or to the national parks? Who will introduce your children to the natural beauty of our area? Who will introduce your children to some of the basic skills of life, like, you know, whatever happened to home economics that used to be taught in school? So how will our children learn to cook or take care of themselves or balance a budget or manage their finances, to ride a bike? What are some of the things that you value as a parent and want to pass on to your children? And how will you make that happen and fit in under the demands of increased education that's necessary, the demands of homework? There's a lot of controversy about the amount of homework that students are expected to do, and is it really a value? It's interesting because, you know, there are so many studies that show that the amount of homework that students do really does not correlate to how well they achieve on tests or how much they take away from their education. And I often, you know, when I think about what I believe is the goal of a public education, I think it has very little to do with, you know, the day-to-day lessons learned, but more how our students feel about learning, how excited they are to go to school and to be a part of taking in new information, instead of the stress of feeling like I have to get an A or I have to learn this, but just kind of the fun and curiosity of learning something new. There was a study that was done in 2010, and it's really interesting to me because we're talking about school boards and their function in each district. And it was a questionnaire that asked the National School Board Association members to rank their goals for education. And they came up with 6 goals. Number 1 was to help students to fulfill their potential, 42.6%. percent of the members ranked that as number 1. Number 2 is to prepare students for a satisfying and productive life. 31% of the school board members ranked that. Number 3 was to prepare students for the workforce. Only 8% ranked that as a top priority. Number 4 was to prepare students for college. Only 8% of the school boards mentioned that as a top priority. Number 5 was to help students be well-rounded individuals. And number 6 was to prepare students for civic life. And both came in very small percentages. But I thought it was interesting because the boards in large amounts, 87% of the boards, school boards, really believed that it was short-sighted to define the success of their students or their schools on the basis of student achievement alone, and that success goes beyond preparing students for college and the workforce, that there is a much larger purpose to educating our next generation, to making a living, a life, and a difference. And I found that interesting because that doesn't seem to be what our school districts really focus on. That seems to be all about achievement and testing and college prep. So I don't know where the school boards were, the 87% that said this, but I find that really fascinating. And it was interesting because after that study came out, the Fordham Foundation, which is a education think tank and policymakers, they said that, you know, that kind of idea or that kind of thinking from the school boards is incredibly short-sighted, because in our globally competitive world that actually emphasizes, you know, achievement or high technology, that there should be much more than only 8% or 16% total emphasis on preparing children or students for the workforce or college, that we need to have actually higher standards, more homework, more challenging curriculum than what we currently have in place. So it seems like we have two conflicting goals for our education. One is that pursuit of happiness, that we want to prepare our children to have a high quality of life. But the other competing goal is one, we need to have students that are able to have a life, to be able to get a job, to be able to buy a home, to be able to meet the demands of technology. So I wonder, you know, really, what is our goal? What are we trying to do each day? Because if we focus solely on job readiness and not on kind of that broader base of knowing how to learn and adapt and be flexible and creative, then what happens, and this is kind of a whole nother piece of it, what happens to all of the students who've only been trained in one way of working when those jobs go away and they have no idea what to do next? So this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, live in the studio today. Our number is 805-781-3875. Are you back to school? Are your children back to school? Or are you back to school as an instructor or maybe not? Where are we in the state of educating our young people? How are we doing? How do you think things are going? Do you think that we're meeting the demands of our society? Do you think we're preparing our children in the ways that matter? Should we be preparing them to be good citizens? Should we be preparing them to just pursue their own happiness and potential? Or should we be, I can't say the words, should we be preparing them for something else? I'd love to know what you think on this. 805-781-3875. So Bree, I guess it's you and me on this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And so how old are you?
I'm 22.
22. Welcome.
Thanks.
To KCBX. You're our new news gal and anchoring the afternoons, right?
Not necessarily midday? Anchoring. I'm like reporting the news, and I'm also been running the board, so like DJing in the middle of the day, including this show. So that's what I'm doing right now and talking.
And where did you come from?
Well, I just graduated from college in Montana, but I'm originally from Washington State.
Mm-hmm. And then now you're down in a whole other part of the world.
I am, yeah.
So how do you feel about the education you received having just graduated? Do you feel ready to take on the demands of the world?
I feel ready. I think it mostly was just because I was given the freedom to explore what I wanted to do. I think a lot of other people just, they don't quite know exactly what they want to do in life. And so they get lost and they end up getting in subjects that they don't really care that much about. Whereas I think with my own education, I kind of knew what I wanted to do early. I mean, it did change quite a bit. I didn't start college wanting to be like, I'm in public radio now. But eventually I got there and I'm here now.
Well, I'm glad that you're here and answering the phones for us. And it looks like we have some callers, 805-781-3875. And it's interesting because I had a really different experience in my education in elementary school and in junior high. So I came up through the public education system in California in the 70s, I guess late 60s, early 70s. And so at that time, there was a lot of money in the school district, and they were able to provide kind of special programs. And so I was lucky enough to be identified with this gifted and talented piece of the Cupertino School District. And they, at that time, were experimenting with taking these students out of our regular schools and kind of putting us all together in one school. And so from third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh grade, I was with this same group of 50 students, or I don't know if there was that many of us, and we were kind of tracked and together all the way through our education. And there was a lot of money put towards us. I think we spent most of our time doing field trips, and traveling as a group different places. We had lots of guests that came into our classroom. We had scientists who came in and did special experiments with us. Anything we were interested in as a group, our teachers would explore. And I never remember from third grade through sixth grade until we entered junior high sitting for a lesson or any formal curriculum, or, you know, this is your math time or this is your, you know, reading time. We kind of were, felt like it was a grand experiment that was going on. I mean, I don't think we recognized it was an experiment because it was our classroom, but we set up our own economies. We set up our own newspaper. We set radio stations. I mean, our classroom was kind of a microcosm of what life would be like outside of school. And we just kind of explored whatever was interesting, and we all had different things. And most of, you know, the students that I've kept track of as we've gotten older, everyone has done quite well, but it was certainly not a traditional education by any means, especially not even close to what my children had and how little funding we do for, you know, gifted and talented education today. In some ways, it's almost become like the shameful stepchild over in the corner. We don't fund, you know, extended learning or gifted programs. And so I wonder how we help our students get to where they need to go. 805-781-3875. Hello, Chaz. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, Elizabeth. This is Chaz.
Hi there. Hey, thanks for calling.
What I see is a lot of times, it's interesting that you say that only 8% of the school board said that they're preparing kids for college.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, not every kid needs to go to college. With the reduction in school funding, you don't see shop classes. And like you said, economics classes. Some, not every kid should go to college and incur the large debt or whatever, or go to some prestige place like UCLA or Cal or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Some kids, they need to have trade school. And so, if we had more manufacturing, maybe that would help. But, you know, the end goal seems to be in our local high schools is to push kids to go to school and to go to some really cool school when not every kid should go to school.
Well, and that was kind of why that study surprised me, because that's been my experience, that the school districts here locally really are focused on college prep and workforce prep.
Yeah, very much so.
So what happened, you know, and it is funny because we know that shop classes and home economics classes kind of went the way of the dinosaur, that they seem to not be needed. But it seems like more than ever, young people need those basic skills, especially if, you know, home ownership is going to be so expensive, or we're going to need to be able to keep our cars running, or being able to manage a budget in a tight economic times. Where are they going to learn those skills if not at school?
Well, it is pretty shocking how we discovered as our kids grew up through school, there is no basic life classes.
Mm-mm.
You know, they're pushing so hard, like you said, for testing and AP classes and shining as far as making the school look good academically, which is great. But on the other hand, there are so many kids that get to the end of high school and don't know the first thing about a checkbook,
right,
or how to balance their everyday life, or how to look for a job, or how to think about getting an apartment, or basic life skills. You don't see that. And I don't blame the school, because of the emphasis of where the funding is pushed is where how schools get rated and how they get their money and stuff. But basic life skills are not emphasized in the schools. And I don't know. It comes to parents' job, I know. But facing everyday life should be taught to a lot of these kids, because, like I said, not all kids need to go to college.
Well, and even the ones that go to college, and, you know, it's shocking the amount of students who enter college who don't finish college. They come out with debt, but they don't even have a diploma. That's a whole nother conversation. But, you know, even the college graduates aren't learning life skills at the university. I mean, Cal Poly is really good about helping with resume writing and, you know, doing interviewing and kind of those job-related or career-related skills. But where and when are students going to learn? And it seems, you know, I almost feel like embarrassed and old-fashioned saying this, but somebody needs to wash the clothes. Somebody needs to know how to cook a meal. Like those things that we seem to see as, you know, demeaning or below us. But the fact remains that a good part of my week after week, even without children at home, revolves around cleaning my house and, you know, feeding my pets and knowing when to take them to the vet and cleaning, you know, my clothes. Like those daily living skills are still the thing I spend the most time with. So,
yeah.
So how, you know, if we don't teach those skills, how will our children learn how to do this?
Well, trial and error, like we did, fumbling and looking stupid part of the time, but you know, we muddle through.
So you're okay with not having having that be part of the school curriculum?
No, I think life skills should be part of the school curriculum, and the emphasis on college, I guess my point is I'm surprised that the 8% figure came out, because it seems like that is the total direction of our educational systems around here, is to push a kid into college, and you're worthless unless you go to college, and then the peer pressure to go to a really good college creates a lot of problems that our kids really don't need to have.
Well, and I don't know about you, Chaz, but I have said often that the minute my youngest graduated from high school, I had that pit in my stomach of wanting a do-over. Because the minute she was in college and I was done, all of a sudden I started seeing all the things that I probably would have done differently if I myself hadn't gotten caught up in the frenzy towards...
Oh, true. True. Yeah, that's true for all of us. Because, you know, even though ideally our kid, our success isn't indicative of how our kid accomplished things, it's but it is a reflection on us. So we want our kids to look cool and do cool things, so we look good too. But we should care more about what the kid needs.
Yeah. And it's a wide range of things. Thank you for taking the time to call.
Okay. Thank you.
Have a wonderful day. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. If you're just tuning in, we're back to school. I started off talking about how much I love back to school, first day of school pictures. And you can check out my girls, a couple pictures from when they were young on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or follow us on Instagram at The Reluctant Therapist. You can always find me at Elizabeth at TheReluctantTherapist.com or listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. I am back in the studio today taking calls, 805-781-3875, talking about education and what is the purpose of a public education? What is it that you want for your children? Have you sat down and made your own parenting plan or lesson plan and thought about what is it my child needs to know from the time they're born till when they leave home at 18 or when they get in that car and spend most of their time driving around at 16? It's not a long time that we have to prepare our students for life. And so if we can't expect our public schools to be, you know, cover all of the bases, if it's not going to have a shop class and teach us how to repair things at home or take care of a car or change the oil, if we're not going to have home economics, then so we're not going to prepare young people for how to balance a family budget. And it's interesting because as we've seen classes, you know, life skills classes or home economics move away from the curriculum, we've also seen an all-time high in the lack of savings in our and people in our culture, that we are woefully under-saved as a nation, that people are on the hairy edge. And where will we learn those things? What other things do you want your children to learn? In my house, I really wanted the girls to have an understanding of basic cooking skills, so because I didn't really have any, and I don't think I'm still wonderful, but some basic cooking skills. But I also wanted them to have, you know, a love for music, a love for performance, a love for sports, right? A love for movement. And I had to introduce those things because my girls weren't going to know about it unless they were introduced to it. That's, to me, one of the beauties of education, of school, to come together with people of all different kinds of interests who then expose your children to different things that they love. And I remember one of my oldest daughters, one of my favorite teachers that she had, Mrs. Biddleston, Diana Biddleston. One of the things I loved about her class is that she was really great about introducing to her students the things that she loved, like scuba diving or plants. I can't remember all the things. I always think of scuba diving. She had pictures everywhere and she'd talk a lot about it, try and inspire the children to want to be involved. She was an artist also. She did a lot of art in class. And I think, you know, even more than the curriculum itself that's being taught, it's the life of the teacher, who that person is, who that educator is, that really inspires the students. Because I don't remember anything really in detail that I learned from Mr. Cherry's class. But I remember Mr. Cherry and I remember things he said and who he was outside of the classroom. And so I wonder if we, you know, don't value enough those things that help us to grow as individuals, as the people that are teaching our students. One of the other things that I was thinking about when I was putting this show together was, you know, all of the different areas or institutions or foundations or groups that are trying to have an influence on the direction of our public education today. You know, there is, I talked about the Fordham Foundation. Also, of course, Bill and Melinda Gates have their own foundation, and they're trying to work towards getting students college ready. They want students to be able to adapt to the online world and to be able to learn in multiple ways, not just in the classroom as an individual, but one-on-one, to be able to do work outside of the classroom online. They want students to be able to meet the technological challenges of the society that's coming up ahead of them. And they're also, you know, big on one laptop per child. A laptop for every student seems to be a big push with a lot of technological companies. The Chan Zuckerberg Education Initiative, they are trying to get funding and money into having one-on-one tutoring, one-on-one ratio learning with students, which I can't imagine how that would ever happen. But apparently their research shows that that one-on-one learning has the highest success rates. And in President Obama's final State of the Union address, he actually proposed the idea that I brought up earlier of helping all students learn to code, to learn that language. And I mentioned at the start of the show that this couple that I met flying out to Denver, he owns a technology firm, and he really felt it was important that his students, his children graduate being able to speak that language, that second language of coding and software, computer science. And so President Obama said, you know, I think that we should be offering all students hands-on computer science and math classes to make them job ready on day one out of school. And so already, you know, the school systems in New York and in Los Angeles have announced that they're going to move towards including computer science as part of their curriculum. And as I say, we don't have a national curriculum. You know, we don't have an overall goal that is set out by the government. So it's up to individual districts and individual areas and the parents in these districts and these areas to speak up for what it is they find to be most important. Currently, I think there's only 1/10 of all of the high schools in our country offer any sort of computer science class. So if we're talking about being job ready for technology, I guess that's what's important, is being able to speak the language. But on the other hand, there's been a lot of research and a lot of conversation over the last 10 years about this very narrow focus of preparing our students to be technologically savvy. Are we doing them any favors by only having them ready to do one job, to go into the world of technology? There was an article written by Jeff Salingo. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Salingo. He is a writer for the Washington Post. And he wrote an article about, you know, this move towards the computerization and automation of everything in our country, and how the more automated and computerized we become, even though it's technologically advanced and can, you know, save a lot of time and maybe energy and, you know, help us with a lot of global problems, it's also going to result in stripping away millions of mid-level jobs. One of the examples he gave was this move towards self-driving big rigs, which would mean the end of, you know, 3 million jobs of those who drive big rigs across the country today. And then for a lot of women who are work as office administrators, the move towards automation in offices is going to lead to the loss of over 5 million mid-level jobs. But he also talked about not just mid-level jobs, but also in some of the higher earning jobs, that the more technologically smart we get, the more we kind of innovate our ways out of work. And so he said, you know, instead of trying to come up with one fits all education system, we need to think about what kind of education we need to stay ahead of automation or to complement technology, instead of, you know, just being trained to be able to code or write software or do big data mining. Now that we need to have our students or have our young people be prepared to adapt, to be able to be creative, to change jobs midstream, to be able to move out into different technologies. Because if we have, for example, it's kind of like the lumberjack story. You know, if you have generations of people who worked as lumberjacks, but we've clear cut all the forests and there literally is no job for the lumberjacks to have, then we need to start moving our training so that you have all these people who made their living doing one thing being able to do something else. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of this conversation with a reluctant therapist. We're talking about the state of education. It's my first day back here. I'm curious to know, how was your summer? Are you ready for back to school? I know that for a lot of moms, it's the party of the summer once the kids are dropped off for the first time and everyone gets to go back to their day-to-day life with the kids in school all day and moms and dads off to work. And how is our model for public education working out? Are our children learning everything they need to know? As a reluctant therapist, I think a lot about the social-emotional piece of it. And if we're really preparing young people to be able to take on the pressures and stresses of life socially and emotionally, we might have fantastic test takers, but do we have someone who's able to deal with the realities of climate change, you know, changes in our economics, being able to, you know, adapt to the expectations of the day-to-day pressures? 805-781-3875. Hi, Jackie, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, Elizabeth. Good to hear you again. I'm glad you had a good summer trip.
I did. Ultimate summer vacation.
Sounded wonderful. I taught philosophy for 20 years at Cuesta College, and I just would like to get your thoughts on the idea of introducing the students at the high school level, perhaps even younger than that, elementary, junior high, to ethical questions, ethical dilemmas. The other day, my husband and I were watching Eye in the Sky, and I thought, boy, you know, if I were still teaching, I'm retired now, if I were still teaching, I might, you know, take that movie and show it to my students. Because it showed all these different angles of, you know, what kind of decisions would you be up against. And I'm not so sure whether our students are, you know, prepared in that respect of thinking about moral dilemmas. And so, yeah, just wanted to get your feedback on that.
Well, Jackie, I thank you for calling in. You know, and that's kind of right up my alley, that I think about education, I think much more about being able to think critically and about deep issues, almost being more important than, can I, you know, type quickly? I mean, it's nice to be able to type, but I think we spend so much time training young people to be workers and not enough to be thinkers, because you can find any information. You know, it's funny, my husband, anytime he has a dilemma now, he goes to YouTube and watches a video on how to do it. So our students in some ways don't need us at all, right? Because if there's anything they need to learn, they can YouTube a video. But to have conversations about ethical dilemmas or moral dilemmas or citizenship, that's what expands us as humans.
Yes, I agree, and I'm not so sure whether they're getting introduced to those kinds of questions. For an example, if they were even introduced to a little bit of philosophy, you know, some of the things that questions that were raised by Socrates. I mean, these kids are smart; they can figure it out. You can put it in a language that they understand.
Absolutely,
right? You know. And I'm sure you're dealing with that in your class. I'm getting a feeling like there's a moral vacuum a little bit in our country going on. And I know you addressed that as well, that, you know, our kids are growing up in a world where they're getting hit with a lot of different challenges. Mm-hmm. And you know, they probably are not getting a whole lot of guidance, except if they're lucky enough to have parents like you. if parents like you and your husband. But if they're not, they're like out there thrown to the wind, as it were. And, you know, it would be, I think, a great thing for these children to be introduced to some of these questions to get them to think, well, would this be the right thing to do in this particular situation? And you can come up with all sorts of moral dilemmas that relate directly to their lives and the kind of things that they're facing, including,
Absolutely.
You know, what happens when you get pregnant? And, you know, I mean, that's that's difficult terrain there. I don't know if I want to go in that direction right off. But, you know, there are things that they're facing, and they need to have some kind of discussion, I think, on what it means to have a conscience and what it means to reflect on what it is to have empathy for others.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah,
I just
thought maybe you could pick up the ball on that. And
well, Jackie, you might have to come out of retirement because clearly there's a need for these conversations. And thanks for calling in, because, you know, that's precisely the thing I'm questioning, is that what is it our children need to know when they get out there in the world? I mean, we heard the news, I don't know if it was this summer, about the young man who took over the pharmaceutical company and then jacked up the price of the med from $17 to $175. If he had had Jackie's ethics course at Cuesta, would he have been so bold in doing this? 805-781-3875. Hi, Paul, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, I don't know how much I can contribute to the conversation, but because I never had kids, but I did go to school.
Good for you.
I went to school in the Cupertino School District in the 60s and 70s also. But
we were together then.
Yeah, I guess. I went to Homestead High School.
I did too.
Funny.
When did you graduate? We're going to have to go off book here, Paul. When did you graduate?
1979.
So did I.
That's funny.
Paul, we know each other.
Yes. I know, it's hilarious.
All right, all right, continue on. This is just so interesting.
Anyway, mm-hmm. Yeah, that is funny. I read this article this morning. It was on the Christian Science Monitor about some letter that went viral from a teacher in the Midwest somewhere who told her class, you know, I'm not giving you any homework this year. I spent the whole summer researching homework, and the studies prove that homework is not effective. In fact, it's kind of the opposite. And so everybody was like, yay, in the class, and kind of went viral. And apparently this isn't a new concept, and that she said that she would rather her students stay home and have dinner with the family and play games and be a kid rather than being strapped with hours and hours of homework. And I thought it was really interesting.
Well, and since we went to the same school district, I don't remember doing homework one night the whole 4 years I was at Homestead High School. I don't remember having homework at night. Did you?
Not really. Not. I don't remember being strapped down with it at all.
So it is a real change. And I did read that same article, and what I loved about it, it was the emphasis on do things as a family, right? Do the things that matter. That's the time when parents get to actually do their teaching for their children, expose them to the things they're interested in, instead of rehashing what went on in the school that day, to spend the time having an ethical conversation at the dinner table, right? To expand our children's learning beyond just that day-to-day.
Right. And, you know, it's funny. Another part of this conversation is I didn't have kids, and so I don't see them going into college and all that. But I've seen lots of my friends where their kids go into college, and they're like a deer in the headlights. What in the heck is an 18-year-old person? How are they supposed to figure out what they're going to do for the rest of their lives with passion?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get to my age now, my work is, you know, I enjoy what I do, but I never probably dreamed what I would be doing. But it's not the most important thing in my life. In fact, it's far from it.
Well, and that's another conversation that we'll have down the road, is this difference between, you know, working to live and living to work. And at some point, we kind of switched our focus from, I go to work so that I can provide for the life that I enjoy outside of this, and not fully identifying my whole existence around what I do each day for a paycheck, that there's got to be some balance in that.
Well, it's way weighted toward the career and the job, and, you know, and that's the dead end that sends people to therapy when they're in their 40s.
Absolutely.
They're like, my life is worthless, it's meaningless, and I'm just freaking out with addictions and all kinds of, you know, problems. I'm freaking out.
And you think we would
put all their eggs in that basket.
And so then again, from my perspective, I think, wow, this generation should have figured this out. Wouldn't we be the parents that are saying, I don't want you to get to 40, 50 years old and look back and say, it was all about my work, but I never developed anything else. So how do we find that balance between, you know, what we do as our career and what we do to develop ourselves as individuals? And the third part, and Jackie brought it up, and it's a big thing for me, is how do we continue the ethics of this nation, the founding ideals of this nation, if we also don't really work to develop full citizens, people who feel that being part of this democratic society is more than just getting a paycheck, that we owe our time and service and attention civically to this country to keep it running. And that never seems to come up.
Right. In fact, when you read that piece at the beginning, or I think about the 2 minute, 2 hour, 2:30 or something like that, you read, or maybe it was the beginning where you read all about what originally
Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't really resemble anything about school nowadays.
No. It was much more about exploration and growing. Paul, I'm glad you called in. And if you get a chance, drop me an email, Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. I want to figure out if we knew each other back in the day.
Okay, I will.
Thanks for calling in. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Carol, last thoughts today. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm just grateful to be on the show. I'm retired many years now, and how we can prepare young people to multitask, I think that is it. And I loved President Obama's idea about teaching them coding early on. Mm-hmm. But with coding, there were 64 people that started in our class of coding, and there were 4 who finished and 3 who passed the test.
Oh, my goodness.
So if you want to go by the percentages, those kind of percentages are difficult. But in general, people who are really good at math are going to be able to code. So the trick is teaching them math early, 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 and the love for math, teaching them coding early. Because look at what's happened with all the computer kids at 4, mm-hmm. And earlier even. It's wonderful, really. But you have to remember that putting all those people out of jobs, the jobs that are coming are going to be fixing the technology, mm-hmm. maintaining the technology. And they're going to have to the more automated they get, it's going to be this huge workforce.
Yeah, it's going to be switching us back to being able to do the tech jobs, right? To be able to fix the things we've created.
That's right. That's so true.
Carol, thank you for calling in. This has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and I'm glad we got to start this conversation rolling about education and what it is our students need. And I think over the course of the fall, I really want to retouch on some of these topics, because I hope I've planted a seed, you know, about what are our jobs as parents? What is our parental plan, our lesson plan for what our kids need to know? And how involved are we in the education system? Are we comfortable with our school board? Is our school board meeting the needs of our students in ways that we value? And number 3, what is it that we want for our children when they leave their education? Do we want them to be thinkers, or they want them to be workers, or they need to be a combination of both? I'm always happy to hear from you at Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Check out our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or on Instagram @thereluctanttherapist. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast.